It shows that God knew everything that was going to unfold in world history long before it came to pass.
This is Mission 66, based on the teaching ministry of Bible teacher and pastor Dr. Luis Seau, and produced by TWR. Today, we're in the Book of Esther, and our teacher John Matthews and co-host Esther Sisulu will be guiding us. This short book is the story of how God can use a single person to change lives and nations. Grab your study guide at mission66.org and let's get started on today's discussion.
Welcome, dear friends, and thank you for joining us today as we begin the book of Esther. Now, she lived hundreds of years ago in the kingdom of Persia, and she was of Jewish origin. And through the guiding hand of God, she was brought into the kingdom palace for just such a time as this. Well, our teacher, John Matthews, will lead us through chapter one with the theme, The Queen Gets Checkmated.
Thank you so much, Esther. What is it like to be reading the book after which you are named?
Well, it feels like it has arrived for such a time as this. It's amazing.
Yeah, good. Well, look, welcome home. And a very warm welcome to you to this latest episode of Mission 66, wherever you are today and whatever your situation. So good to be with you and have your company, where we do start our journey in the book of Esther. And, you know, let's just paint the picture of the historical situation that we have here, because the scene is the Persian capital of Susa, and it's during the reign of King Xerxes. Now, we've just been in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah on Mission 66, and that describe, those books describe how the Judeans had been kept captive in Babylon and then Persia, were given permission to go back to Judea and rebuild the city of Jerusalem. And the first wave of those who returned was headed up by a civic leader, a guy called Zerubbabel, who, along with a priest by the name of Joshua, organized the rebuilding of the temple on the grounds where Solomon's temple had once stood itself. Then a few years later, there was another wave of returnees coming back under Nehemiah with the mission to rebuild the wall around the city. That wall had been torn down by the invading Babylonians some decades before. And then there followed a third wave of returnees, and they were led by Ezra the priest, who led the returning Judeans in a great revival, really. And the timeline then goes a little something like this. 516 BC before Christ, the restored temple in Jerusalem is completed. That's described in Ezra. But then events in the book of Esther take place in that gap from 483 to 471 BC. Now, that's before Ezra led the second return of exiles in 458 BC. Then 14 years after Ezra led the return of exiles, 444 BC was when Nehemiah, the third return of exiles, came and the wall was rebuilt. So here we are. We're situated in the gap, if you like, between the first and the second wave of returnees. And the name of the Persian king is Ahasuerus in the Hebrew, but history knows him as Xerxes, one of the great military kings, actually, in history. And the narrative in the book of Esther fits with the historical account. So let's read chapter one. Now, in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus, who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media, and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him, whilst he showed the riches of his royal glory, and the splendour and the pomp of his greatness for many days, and 80 days. There's part there of 6 months, isn't it? And verse 5 says, when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast that lasted for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. And there were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars, and also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels, vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king, and drinking was according to this edict. There is no compulsion, for the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desired. Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. Now, this is some party, isn't it? And it's thrown to rally and encourage his military leaders because he had grand designs to quash his enemies in Egypt, in Babylon, and in Greece. And he's best known for his massive invasion of Greece from across the Hellespont around the time of 480 BC. It was a campaign that would include the battles of Thermopylae, Salamis, and Plato. But at this point, that was all in the future, because here Xerxes is building his arsenal and his army, and indeed his alliances. Let's read on, verse 10. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mechuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, and Abagtha, Zetha, and Carcas, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown, in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. She was being summoned here, Queen Vashti, by order of the king to come and effectively parade herself before all these army officials and officers. Verse 12. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. And at this the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure towards all who were versed in law and judgment, that the men next to him being Karshina, Shetha, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marsina, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media, who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom. And so the king said, according to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti, because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs? Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and all the peoples who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behaviour will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they all say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media, who have heard of the queen's behaviour, will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. If it please the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be repealed that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So, when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, for it is vast, all women will give honour to their husbands, high and low alike. And this advice pleased the king and the princes. And the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people in its own language, that every man be master in his own household, and speak according to the language of his people. So that, Esther, is the Bible account. So let's do a quick summary here. King Xerxes the Great hosts this extravagant banquet to display his wealth, his power and his influence. And for 180 days, in fact, it lasts. It says that he showcases his vast wealth of the kingdom and indeed the splendor of his majesty. And following that, he holds another 7-day feast in the palace gardens for everybody in the citadel of Susa, from the richest to the poorest. And the chapter describes the grandeur of the setting, these white and blue linen hangings fastened with cords of white linen and purple material, silver rings, marble pillars, couches of gold and silver on these mosaic floors, with costly stones and marble, royal wine in abundance served in these goblets of gold, each different from the other. And the king is allowing each guest to drink as much, or indeed as little, as they please. And then we're introduced to Queen Vashti, who hosts her own banquet for the women of the palace. And King Xerxes, well, he's well in to drinking wine, and he's merry, is the way the chapter describes him. And in this merriment, King Xerxes calls upon 7 eunuchs. Each of them are actually named in the chapter, and their job is to summon Queen Vashti, adorned in her royal crown, to display her beauty to the guests, who are, I imagine, plenty of whom would have had a few drinks as well. But Queen Vashti refuses, and this stirs up an alcohol-inflamed anger against Vashti, which the king was to later regret. And who can blame Vashti for saying, no, thank you, I'd rather not do that. So here, though, you have a scenario where the great King Xerxes, who's ruler over 127 provinces of the mighty Persian Empire, is showcasing his power and his influence, only to be refused by his own wife. And so the advice the king is getting is that, well, king, is this going to make you look weak? And so here he is. He's alcohol inflamed. His pride is high. And he can't see clearly. He consults his legal experts, 7 trusted advisors. The names are given there as well. And the reality is, are they going to back up Queen Vashti? Not a chance. And so he says, according to the law, what must be done to the queen? And so they advise that this public refusal from the queen to obey the king was going to be a signal, they think, to every wife in the entire empire to do the same to their husbands, which would infect the entire empire. There's some illogical panic in their response. But their response is that they need to make an example of Vashti by deposing her as queen. And let's be honest, this does not make easy reading for us. Bad decisions made under the influence of alcohol, and a decision that the king was to later regret, and with no thanks at all to his legal experts, who effectively just brush his ego rather than talking some logic and truth to him.
You're listening to the program Mission 66, and I'm Esther, your host. And today we are covering the book of Esther, and this is unbiasedly one of my favorite books in the Bible. Well, nonetheless, we are here with our teacher, John Matthews, who's taking us through chapter 1. And John, let's start off firstly with who wrote the book of Esther. Seeing as, you know, this is a historical account, where are we now in the historical timeline?
Well, it's most likely written by either Ezra or Nehemiah, who were contemporaries of Esther. this historic account is taking place in what is referred to as the post-exilic period. That is after the Judean people had left Babylon and Persia. After the year 539, King Cyrus of Persia allows the Jews to begin returning to Judah and Jerusalem. Now, Persian culture is very different from the Semitic cultures. They were not the same. And it's possible that the Persian kings came to the conclusion that nobody was benefiting by forcing the Hebrews to stay if they didn't want to. So he issues this proclamation that says anybody who wants to return to Judah is allowed to do so. Now, some returned and some stayed.
Well, that definitely does explain why Esther was still in Persia when Ezra and Nehemiah had already returned and were rebuilding Jerusalem.
Yeah, that's right. You know, Esther's parents, Esther, must have been among those who stayed in Persia. And plenty of good reasons there were as well why they should have stayed. For one thing, well, life now was pretty good in Persia. You know, the people were tolerant of them. They were 70 years in, so they were two or three generations later. The Judeans were free to come and go, to settle down, to buy property, to have a business, to own a farm, to put their roots down. And so many of the children of the exiles, and indeed the children's children, knew nothing other than life in Persia. And so it was home to them. Another reason why many of them stayed was because it was more than 600 miles from Susa to Jerusalem. That's a fairly long distance today, but in those days it was a very, very long way. And the terrain separating Susa and Jerusalem, when it was rough and rocky, plenty of dangers, toils, and potential pitfalls along the way. And so we discern that Esther's parents evidently died in Persia. We don't know the details of that, except that she was now being raised by her uncle, and her uncle's name was Mordecai.
Well, isn't it interesting to note how history remembers King Xerxes? And I suppose he was one of the more outstanding monarchs, wasn't he?
Yeah, and I guess that's why he is remembered. He's known as Xerxes the Great, or in Hebrew, Ahasuerus. And he becomes king in 486 BC. He's the son of Darius I, and he rules until 465 BC. So he makes quite a mark in his 21 years of rule. And he is the one who leads this huge expedition against Greece. And he puts together the largest and best equipped army and navy of his day. And this banquet being described here, well, look, there were possibly many reasons why it was held. And one of those was that it may well have been a recruitment ceremony for his officers who would later serve in that campaign. And he ended up suppressing his enemies, first in Egypt, then later some rebels from Babylonia. But his major goal and his major aim was to take over Greece. And he was later victorious at the famous battle at Thermopylae. But he was an idolater, and he was a great womanizer. And the Book of Esther hints at that. And eventually this coalition of Greek city-states defeated him at the Battle of Salamis. But look, that's not part of our story right here and now. In fact, there's no direct reference to any of the known historical events of Xerxes' reign here in the Book of Esther. Because as so often the Bible does, the focus here is, well, they're on deep, deep values, as we'll discover as the story goes on. And so this book of Esther, it's unique.
Oh, yes, it is. And, you know, something else that makes Esther quite unique, John, is the fact that God is never mentioned in this book. Now, considering that, should that pose a problem for us reading this book?
No, it shouldn't. And you're right in saying that, because God's name doesn't appear, but God's presence, his guidance, his protective oversight, they're evident right throughout the book of Esther without the need of his name to be mentioned. And so it's not a problem. In fact, if anything, the rise of Persia as a world power, it confirms God's prophetic word about world history. think about the dream of Nebuchadnezzar that we'll get to in the book of Daniel. He dreamed of this enormous statue, and this statue had a head of gold, a breastplate of silver, a waist of bronze, and legs of iron. Now, Daniel correctly interpreted the dream, saying that Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold, and that the Babylonian Empire was the first of four empires that would arise. The breast of silver, well, that represented the rise of the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. The waist of bronze foretold the rise of the Greek Empire after they conquered Persia. And then later would come the legs of iron, and that represented the Roman Empire. What a dream that was, and we'll explore that dream and its correct interpretation when we get to the book of Daniel. And it just shows us, doesn't it, Esther, again, that God knew everything that was going to unfold in world history long before it came to pass.
So, John, this first chapter of Esther, our introductory chapter, really highlights Queen Vashti's beauty. It really describes how lovely she was. Yet, she actually disobeyed. She refused the king's invitation, which caused quite a stir. Did this happen often? Was this the practice of the queen towards the king, or just in general?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting point. And Queen Vashti, you know, you could describe her as the originator of women's liberation for standing up against chauvinists. And good for her, because there was plenty of reason here to stand her ground. She's conducting her own banquet for the women, so is plenty busy besides what's going on with her husband, the king, and certainly doesn't appreciate being summoned effectively to be gawked at by a bunch of drunken partygoers. And we see Queen Vashti's rebuff against her husband. And what is she rebuffing? Well, she's rebuffing being humiliated in front of all these men. And so, quite rightly, Esther, she is having none of it.
Oh, yeah, indeed, John. She stood her ground. Now, you know, I have heard it said by some who oppose the Bible that the reason why they oppose it is because they feel the Bible disrespects women. Now, is that really a fair assessment of the Bible?
No, it's not a fair assessment at all. And it's actually a lie. It's not true. Because both men and women were both created in God's image. Yes, the intention was they would have separate roles, but that they would be together as a team. And that is the goal of life. That was the aim when God created the world perfect. He created it with the aim of there being mutual cooperation for the general good of all who lived in that world. And certainly not one party dominating the other. And that kind of behavior enters the world only when sin enters the world. And it is a product, unfortunately, of sin, of a fallen world. And we see it between men and women, but we see it between men and men. We see it between women and women. We see it everywhere in our world, the desire to control and dominate, because that is part of our fallen human nature. And the beautiful thing about faith in Jesus Christ is we don't need to do that stuff anymore. We don't need to prove ourselves, because we are proven in Christ. We are children of our Heavenly Father. And the need to be unkind to other people who are not like us, or to try and gain dominance over them for some reason, that ends. And Jesus Christ said the first will be last and the last will be first. Jesus said, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." Utterly countercultural. And so what God created perfect, unfortunately sin spoiled, but there is a way back to the way that God intended.
Well, John, that was a fascinating start to our journey through the book of Esther. Thank you too for your insights. Listener, I hope that you'll stay with us now as we continue with a summary wrapping up chapter one.
Yeah, let's do that. So this book of Esther unfolds in the Persian capital of Susa during King Xerxes' reign. And the account follows the events after the Judeans were allowed to return to Jerusalem under leaders such as Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah. And then you have Esther, a Judean orphan who's being raised by her uncle, a guy called Mordecai, who had remained in Persia alongside many others who had chosen not to return to Judea. And the journey would have been a rough one for many, and life in Persia, well, it was good enough. So many chose to stay. And so we find the book of Esther beginning with this lavish 180-day banquet hosted by the king Xerxes, where he's showcasing his wealth and his power, encouraging his military leaders in preparation for future campaigns against Greece. His wife, Queen Vashti, is hosting her own banquet, but she defies the king's command to display her beauty before his guests, many whom would have been drunk. And that got Xerxes in his merriment. Well, the merriment turns pretty sharpish because he gets angry. It's often a sign of alcohol as well, isn't it? So angry, in fact, that he removes her as queen. And that act was seen as a threat to males all over the empire. At least that's what the advisers were telling the king. And they tell her, well, you need to divorce her and send her off. Now, God's name isn't mentioned in the book of Esther, but his fingerprints, as we're about to discover, are all over the events that follow.
Yes, indeed. And we're going to continue seeing the hand of God in the story of Esther when we continue studying through this book next time here on Mission 66. Thank you so much for joining us, friend. I am Esther for John and our team, and we'll see you next time.
Let me remind you to head on over to mission66.org to download your study guide. It's free. Dive deeper into the Bible teaching of John Matthews and learn how it all relates to your Christian walk. Tag along with John and Esther on our Bible road trip, episode by episode. Your study guide's waiting for you at mission66.org. That's where you can also post your questions or make a comment, and even help out with a donation to keep Mission 66's heart beating around the world. Hop on over to mission66.org. Mission 66 is a partnership of TWR and the ministry of Dr. Luis Seau.